to the third case of the day, Steinbeck versus Dixon. Mag.
May it please the court, counsel. This is an appeal of summary judgment order of a 1983 excessive force case. The crux of the plaintiff's argument, my name is Thomas Mag, I represent the plaintiff, Mr. Steinbeck, is that he was arrested on a traffic ticket warrant and he was handcuffed in such a way as it ripped both of his rotator cuffs in his shoulders, thereby severely injuring him and requiring surgery. This case ensued, and there were some depositions taken, and counsel for the defendants filed a motion for summary judgment on behalf of her clients, the three defendants. There was a fourth defendant that the plaintiff voluntarily dismissed out. It's not part of this appeal. The two of the three defendants remaining in this case filed a motion for summary judgment, quite simply arguing that there's no clearly established law that the method of handcuffing as described by the defendants was violated any clearly established law. Notably, the issue raised in that summary judgment motion was the second prong of the qualified immunity test, not the first prong, i.e., whether or not excessive force was actually used. Similarly, the third defendant, Sheriff Albrecht, filed a motion for summary judgment, not on the qualified immunity argument at all, but on the basis that he personally did not handcuff my client, the plaintiff. Those issues were briefed. And quite simply, the district court, Judge Scott, granted summary judgment, not on any basis raised by Sheriff Albrecht, or not on the second prong of the qualified immunity test, but solely and exclusively began and ended her analysis with whether or not excessive force was used. Obviously, that's a different issue than was raised by counsel in her motion and that was briefed by the parties. And for that reason, if Judge Scott was inclined to rule or consider the issue of excessive force, i.e., the first prong of the qualified immunity test, she should have given my client notice, hey, I'm considering doing this. Give me your thoughts. Give me what you got.
At the time that the judge ruled, wasn't she required to address the first prong under the prevailing Supreme Court precedent before she addressed the second prong?
Under Saucier as it existed, in order to analyze a qualified immunity test, she was required to analyze both. That's, of course, been subsequently overruled by the Supreme Court in Pearson shortly before the briefs were filed in this case. However, of relevant note is counsel did not move for summary judgment on the first prong of it. She only moved for summary judgment in the case of defendants McFarland and Dixon on the second prong of it. Well, I would say that the only issue that was raised in the summary judgment motion was half of a qualified immunity test, not the entire qualified immunity test.
How could the judge have addressed the second prong without having, how could you as counsel have addressed the second prong without at least having addressed the first or become aware of the law on the first?
Well, quite simply, the second prong, I'm certain you're well aware, is that there's some law out there or some authority that should put a reasonable officer on notice that his actions violate clearly established norms. Quite simply, there's evidence in this record that Defendant Dixon admits that if plaintiff's version of the events is true, that that would constitute excessive force. And there's case law on the authority. So how would you address the second prong without the first prong? While you'd have to touch somewhat on the first prong, there'd be no need to go into any of the detail necessary for a straight-up analysis of excessive force.
Well, to address the second prong alone, doesn't the court assume a constitutional violation?
I think it would have to, yes.
Right. So how have you been harmed here? Presumably, once the motion was made, you would have had to address that assumption and either did or didn't do it at your peril.
Well, again, for instance, under Rule 12D, which admittedly applies to motions to dismiss and not summary judgment, If the court is going to consider something outside the pleadings in a 12b6 motion, it has to give notice under 12d that it's going to do that. By the same token, if a court is going to consider something outside of the scope of a defendant's motion or even a plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, it should give notice.
My point is that it's not outside the scope. When there's a motion for summary judgment on qualified immunity grounds, under the prevailing legal methodology at the time, that requires a two-step process. And although the motion only addressed the second step, it necessarily assumes that the first step in the inquiry was satisfied in order to get to the second step, which puts you on notice that you better address both.
Well, if you assume that the first step has been satisfied, i.e., you assume a constitutional violation, then nobody would be on notice that the district court might determine something contrary to the assumption.
Okay, I guess I'm not making myself clear. In order to address whether the law was clearly established that this conduct
Yes.
violated the Constitution, you necessarily have to address what this conduct was.
Well,
and you had that opportunity in your response and either did or didn't do it.
The issue as framed by counsel in her motion to dismiss on the second prong of qualified immunity was describing the handcuffing behind the back automatically ipso facto being a constitutional violation, which is not what the plaintiff was claiming.
Well, let me ask a question bearing on that point.
Okay.
It's a little unclear to me exactly what the plaintiff is claiming here. What is the nature of the claim, or are you making two different arguments here? Is the claim one of these, you know, eggshell plaintiff kind of claims that because he was elderly and had pre-existing conditions that he shouldn't have been handcuffed behind his back, or is the claim that the manner in which the handcuffing behind his back was conducted in this case was the violation? Or is it both or neither? I'm having a little difficulty getting a handle on what your claim is.
I don't think that the mere fact that he was handcuffed behind his back by itself satisfies a constitutional violation, and I wouldn't stand in front of you to argue that. What I believe, and what I believe the evidence in this case is, as far as the assertions, is that the manner that he was handcuffed, i.e., quickly forced his arms behind his back and then forced them to stay there after complaints of pain, while he's an elderly gentleman and frail, and his own testimony, it was obvious that that would hurt him, is what the constitutional violation is. I mean, obviously, myself, not an elderly gentleman, can take a lot more force if I were to be arrested than, say, an 80-year-old person in a wheelchair. But that, I mean, one of the most invidious things you can do is treat two things that are different as though they are the same.
Right, but there isn't any evidence that he was in a wheelchair or had any pre-existing conditions that would be aggravated by the application of force in the handcuffing behind the back.
The evidence.
So the only factor we have here is his age, but he otherwise appeared to be able-bodied, I think. Is that not correct? And he wasn't on crutches or in a cast or had, you know, using some kind of assistive devices or anything like that.
No, he was ambulatory. He was an elderly gentleman. The record indicates that he was on disability because he was injured from when he was employed. And his own testimony, which is in the record, is that it was obvious it would injure him to handcuff him that way.
Based on what? I mean, that his own testimony that it was obvious isn't going to get us anywhere.
I think
what evidence is there that made it obvious that if he was handcuffed behind his back, he would be injured?
The obvious nature would be his age and his physical condition as observed by the police officers.
What was his physical condition as observed by the police
officers? He was a 64-year-old disabled retired coal miner.
What was the disability?
He had an injured back, and he could not get his hands behind
him. Were the officers aware that he had an injured back, or was there anything obvious about him that would have put them on notice of that?
He told them he could not get his hands behind his back.
But not because he had a back injury.
No, he didn't have time. I mean, obviously, in an arrest, there isn't sufficient time to go through a complete detailed medical.
So basically, all we have is his age and his request not to be handcuffed.
And his testimony that it is obvious that it would hurt him and that he told the officers that.
Well, that's not, as I said, going to get you anywhere, because otherwise anybody who says, don't handcuff me, would have that claim.
He wasn't asking not to be handcuffed.
He was asking, or don't handcuff me behind my back, I think is what he said, right?
Yeah, and I am out of time, and I'm happy to...
Yes, you may respond, of course.
I mean, what the evidence was in the record is that he told the officer who handcuffed him that he couldn't get his hands behind his back in that manner, asked not to be handcuffed behind his back or not be handcuffed. The testimony of the officers was that they have a transport belt that they can both either handcuff in front or that they carry two handcuffs for persons that can't get their handcuffs all the way back behind them, and that they didn't use that.
Right, but to answer my question, he didn't tell them why. He just said, don't do it.
No, he did not tell them why, and the reason he did not tell them why is because there was insufficient time.
Ms. Mag, does the record reflect what this outstanding traffic warrant...
Speeding. I believe that's in Defendant Dixon's deposition testimony.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Kohner?
Thank you, and good morning to the panel. May it please the court, counsel. I have the honor and privilege here today of representing my clients, the Coupon County Sheriff Albrecht and Deputies Dixon and McFarland before you. And obviously the main issue here, I think the court actually has an absolutely clear view of the issues that are involved here, and I think I will limit my comments to the court brought up. I mean, obviously Judge Scott reviewed the entire record in this case. She reviewed all the deposition testimony that was available to her, and she made a correct decision that there was no constitutional violation in this case, that there was no use of excessive force by any of the officers, and granted summary judgment on behalf of all the defendants. You know, the court obviously looked very carefully also at Mr. Steinbach's testimony. Again, I want to point out that the court, in looking at all the testimony, relied solely on Mr. Steinbach's version of the events. She didn't credit anything that Officer Dixon or Officer McFarland did. She accorded all the weight to Mr. Steinbach's testimony because that was the testimony that was most favorable to him. And at best, in response to my open-ended questions, the only complaint that Mr. Steinbach had was that he said, told the officers he thought his shoulders would hurt if he was handcuffed behind his back, and that they moved his arms behind his back quickly. Counsel, again, in his briefs and in his argument to you, keeps telling everybody that the officers forced his arms back, that he was elderly, that he was frail, that he was inflexible, and that is clearly not what Mr. Steinbach testified to. I know the court has a copy of the transcripts, but again, just going to page 74 of Mr. Steinbach's testimony, and that was in response to Mr. Magg's questions, he asked, fortunately they're compound questions, which I should have objected to, but he said, did they force you? Did they jerk it? Did you put your hands behind your back? How did that happen? And all he answered was, well, they put them back there. He never said anything about forcing his arms. He never said anything about jerking his arms. He didn't testify that they wrenched his arms up behind his back. They didn't say that he shoved him into a wall. Yes?
He did sustain bilateral rotator cuff injuries that required surgery, what, some 6 weeks later or something like that?
Your Honor, with all due respect to counsel, there is absolutely no evidence and there is no medical testimony that the rotator cuff tears that were discovered 2 months after this occurrence were causally related to the conduct of any of the officers.
Well, his testimony is that he didn't have any other injury that would have brought about those surgeries or necessitated those surgeries.
Well, his testimony was that he didn't know exactly what about the conduct of the officers would have caused these injuries. And again, he's not a medical professional. All the discovery at this point in time, by the time I filed summary judgment, fact discovery was closed. It was closed as of May 23rd, and so was the medical discovery. And in fact, I even allowed counsel to attach medical records to his response brief. And again, the only thing that said that the doctor could have said in the medical records was that he most likely, based on his age and the degenerative conditions in his shoulders, had pre-existing tears that may have become symptomatic because of the handcuffing. But again, you know, Mr. Steinbeck completely denied whether or not the fact that he'd had any prior injuries to his shoulder. He didn't have any other injuries such as a heart condition or any problems with arthritis, anything that would have made it difficult for him to put his arms behind his back. You know, counsel also in his reply brief keeps referring to the fact that he claims that he would have had other non-party witness testimony, but yet he filed a motion for Judge Scott to reconsider her grant of summary judgment, and the only thing he provided in terms of any additional evidence was another affidavit from his client, again, trying to elaborate or sort of bolster his claim that there was some excessive force use. He didn't provide any newly discovered evidence or any affidavits from any other witnesses to somehow get Mr. Steinbeck's case into the realm of the use of excessive force, which that would have been the more appropriate time to do that, give Judge Scott an opportunity to review anything additional in terms of whether or not she's going to overrule her decision. It's very clear, counsel obviously, his first argument is that he didn't have notice that the court would address the issue of whether or not there was actually a constitutional violation. Respectfully, I would argue that that isn't accurate. As the court points out, in order to address the issue of qualified immunity, which was the basis for which I brought summary judgment on behalf of Dixon and McFarland, that analysis requires the court to first find whether or not there was actually a constitutional violation. And I know Pearson now says that you can do either. But in this case, the saucier approach was completely appropriate because of the facts. And the facts are pretty contained, and they were pretty straightforward. So obviously the court looked at that issue first and made a determination that there was no constitutional violation.
Governor, may I ask you a question regarding whether or not the record reflects the substance of the dialogue between the complainant and the police, which caused the police to go to the home and arrest Mr. Steinbeck. In other words, they came in response to a call.
They did.
Yeah. Now, did the discovery indicate what the police were told by that?
There was some disturbance between alleged disturbance between a resident, like a neighbor.
Yes, I understand that. But did that neighbor, in making the call, which triggered the police going to the community and arresting eventually Mr. Steinbeck, were they just said it's a domestic disturbance? I mean, do we know what caused the police to arrive at the scene with a decision? I mean, they must have run the name, I guess, to find out about the warrant. I just want to know if the record indicates any sequence there of when the police checked his name, what they were told to expect when they got there.
I don't believe so, Judge. I mean, I know that they talked to the complaining witness, Christine Miller. She, you know, Mr. Steinbeck had left the scene of the area, and as they were going to Al's house, which was just down the road, this is a very small community in Royal Lakes. Everybody kind of knows each other, and they just kind of, when they were going down, they did a check at that point in time to see if there were any outstanding warrants. And there was a traffic warrant for Mr. Steinbeck. So, I mean, they just took him into custody on that. They didn't take him into custody on anything related to the alleged disturbance at Royal Lakes up the street.
Well, I'm just trying to get a sense of where they... were they told that the potential for violence existed? I'm just seeing whether or not the police report, if there is one, what the record would reflect about the state of mind of the police, other than they're obviously checking this for this warrant.
No, I believe Deputy Dixon just said that there was a call about a disturbance. They went there. I don't think that there was any issue about him possibly being violent or anything. I think that they
were
just
following. Was there any inquiry about what the procedures are if you confront an individual with such an outstanding warrant? Whether is this routine practice to arrest somebody on the scene with an outstanding warrant? Was there any indication about the age of this warrant? Just some of the circumstances there.
I don't know the age of the warrant. Obviously, it was a practice to take him into custody, and I think as you hear, read from Deputy Dixon, actually, he was only in handcuffs for like 15 minutes because all he did is they go take him up right up the street to his daughter's house where he posted bond, and he was released. So, I mean, it was their procedure since they were out. I mean, Macoupin County is a very large rural county. So, I mean, council brings up the fact about this transport belt. Well, yeah, when they take people all the way to, you know, the Macoupin County Detention Center, which was about 30 minutes from this location where they were at in Royal Lakes, it's difficult for somebody to sit there with their arms behind their back for a 30-minute ride. When you're just going up the street to have them post $200 for bond, they simply left him in the handcuffs. But I don't believe the domestic call said anything about a weapon or anything about him being violent or anything else. In terms, again, I mean, qualified immunity was the basis upon which the court granted summary judgment. Her decision was correct. With respect to Sheriff Albrecht, again, she didn't go into the issue about whether or not he was personally involved in it because once the court made the determination that there was no constitutional violation and that there was no excessive force used, that decision would have been applied to all the defendants.
Do you concede that your motion for summary judgment addressed only the second prong of the qualified immunity test?
Yes and no, Your Honor. I mean, the fact of the matter is the prongs of qualified immunity are so intertwined. I mean, when you're talking about whether or not something is or is not established, clearly established, you do address the issue of whether or not there's actually a constitutional violation. I concede that for the most part my argument was on whether or not it was clearly established, but within that argument, I believe that I completely addressed the issue of whether or not there was a constitutional violation. And I see that my time is up, and thank you very much to the panel.
Well, your time had expired, but you may have an additional minute.
I just wanted to raise a couple of points in response to some questions of the panel, Your Honor. One, there is nothing in the record as to what the substance of the conversation between the complainant and the dispatcher is because the officers do not recall. Officer Dixon admits that Mr. Steinbeck was not a threat to him. The only threat anybody referenced anywhere in the record that Mr. Steinbeck posed is that he could potentially spit on him, which obviously handcuffs aren't going to prevent that.
Well, in the course of deposition taking, was questions presented with regard to what the practice is if confronted with this kind of a situation, whether it's routine upon discovering an outstanding warrant to handcuff. I'm just trying to get some sense of the backdrop here on the excessive force issue.
Yes, questions were asked. They are contained in both defendants Dixon and McFarland's transcripts, deposition transcripts, which are in the file. Candidly, the defendant McFarland was extremely evasive and really didn't say much at all one way or the other. Defendant Dixon said that while the policy's in place, he can exercise some discretion not to handcuff or to handcuff either with the transport belt or with two. And I would also note that counsel referenced the fact that discovery was closed. A evidence deposition of the doctor can be taken at any time before trial.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mr. Coroner. The case is taken under advisement.